side to him. And he's gonna go to middle for and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them.
Yes, everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Warm Down. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Alan Moore. Alan is a sports journalist over there in Moscow. He's also the host of Capital FM Radio. Alan, thank you for joining me. I am delighted to get you on this because a couple of months ago, I read an article. And the article was entitled, Why Liverpool Won't Win the Premier League This Season. And it was fascinating. And I'll go over a couple of the bullet points about what you've said in this. And then I'm going to ask why we should believe what you're saying, how serious and widespread all of this is, and, we'll get into it. So, in Alan's article, Why Liverpool Won't Win the League, he mentions only one club has retained the title since 08-09. Obviously, you remember who that was, and actually we won three on the bounce at that time. COVID has messed up the rhythm that Liverpool might have. The big line, they'll be cycling off, which for me was... Oh my days, what's going on here? We're talking about caffeine overdoses. We're talking about, do you know what, Alan? The asthma thing, you take it away and you explain, firstly, what's going on at Liverpool? Secondly, why should any of us believe what you're saying?
Listen, Stephen, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's great to have a chance to speak to someone who actually knows the questions they're asking, which is unusual because usually when we have a chance to discuss it, it's with people who say, okay, so explain to us. But I think yourself, most of your viewers and listeners, they will know a lot of what goes on in the background of football because it's kind of like making a sausage. Like, it's nice to eat, but you don't want to see how it's made. And this is the situation with the article about Liverpool. I put it together initially after doing a number of surveys about caffeine use in sports. And did some analysis from my own knowledge and experience of working within professional sports. Liverpool, when I looked at them, I thought, okay, there were some pointers from how they were playing, how they were behaving, and the way they were being treated, especially in the media, was that they were being treated with kid gloves and that people were just so happy that they won, that they finally won a league title after so many years, that they were given a free pass. I had spoken with a lot of journalists who cover Liverpool who were thinking the phenomenal work rate and so on and so forth, that it doesn't seem possible. I kept hearing the words Barcelona, Bayern Munich mentioned, and we both know the situations with both those clubs. Why I should be believed? Well, it's up to the eye of the beholder. I'll put the facts very, very straightforward. Is the people working with the club, for example, the assistant manager, the assistant coach, who was removed from the club and went away to his home country in Holland, this is Pep Linders, to basically study with cyclists and the cycling community how to, you know, increase performance and so on and so forth. And he came back having unseated Željko Buvac, who's now here with us in Dinamo Moscow, who was Jurgen Klopp's number two ever since they were in Germany together when they played together. So, I mean, that was a telltale for me. Željko wasn't openly saying that what they're going to do now is go nuclear because there was pressure on Klopp to get a title, to get over the line and do it. He'd had enough time. They fell short against that blue club that shouldn't be named, I guess, on your show. That was a huge issue, that if they hadn't won the title last year, would Klopp still be there? Unlikely, because of the amount of money that was being spent on them and the promise being given by Pep and Linders that they would definitely win it, that this was the final piece of the jigsaw. Why, in terms of caffeine, because caffeine is heavily used by teams who need to get their players a little bit extra. Now, we've all heard about the special drinks being given to players. You know, if we read between the lines, we say, okay, what's in those drinks? Well, most likely caffeine, most likely L-arginine and different minerals, amino acids to
get them. Which, on the face of things, that's perfectly fine. You can have caffeine.
Listen, I've used them pre-workout, you know, and a lot of people say, no, it's in safe amounts, which is fair enough. But let's put it in a very, very simple way that people understand. We all know you have a cup of coffee in the morning, and then you have an espresso and so on. So eventually your body begins to build up a tolerance to caffeine. So you need to get higher doses and more of it more regularly to try and hit that high to keep going. Now, with that amount of caffeine, we know that it plays havoc on the nervous system. It also puts a lot of pressure on the cardiovascular system. To try and balance that out, then they have to take care of heart, lungs, and so on and so forth, and also muscle. So these guys, you know, they're bigger, stronger, and they're running faster for longer and keeping up that intense pace, but also still being able to focus and control the ball. Because it's no good. I mean, I can run a marathon and, you know, do very, very well, but afterwards I'm not going to be able to control the ball. You know, at a certain amount, whether it's dehydration, whether it's exhaustion, your focus, your motor skills, your control start to deteriorate. So it's what else is being used to do that, because it's fine for players to be able to keep up the same pace for 90 minutes, but then it's what they could do with the ball, the decision-making and so on and so forth. So there's also other telltale signs of how they're able to keep, you know, well for so long. So
you also mentioned in this article, which stood out and which is why I brought you on this week, was because of all of the factors that are at play and this overdosing on caffeine, you predicted 2 months ago that Liverpool was going to go through a slew of muscle injuries. Now, at the moment, the current injury list for Liverpool is Mo Salah's coronavirus, that's one thing. We've got Joe Gomez with a knee and obviously Van Dijk with an ACL, but you've got Oxlade-Chamberlain's out, Reece Williams is out, Thiago Alcantara's out, Fabinho is out, Jordan Henderson is out, Andy Robertson is out, Trent Alexander-Arnold is out. Is this what you predicted?
Partially, yeah, because the body as well can only take, we know that, it can only take so much punishment before things start to fall apart. Now, these guys are so well looked after. These are super professionals with the best masseurs, the best nutritionists, the best doctors going. But when you are going flat out for so long, especially we know the English Premier League has such fast pace, has such aggression and hitting, I would propose maybe that a year and a half ago, Virgil van Dijk wouldn't be out for a season had they not gone nuclear last season. Simply because the flexibility deteriorates as well, because with the amount of caffeine, with the amount of not just caffeine, I mean, with the amount of pressure being put on the limbs and joints and muscles, I said the cardiovascular system, the brain, they do slip a little bit. So seeing so many injuries breaking out, or, you know, muscle injuries and so on, like, I mean, it is indicative, because we saw the same, for example, in other European clubs. We also saw, you know, the case of Leicester City, for example, which I've written it before as well. The people involved with them, with the high amount of caffeine being used, the and other recovery drugs being used as well, that all came initially from cycling, from Mappe in Italy. The people working at Juventus had previously been at Chelsea as well, and were kicked out of Chelsea. So they all came from Mappe, from cycling, and the same then with Pepe Linders, who got his knowledge from cycling. So cyclists are very, very different. They're different animals, we know. They also need to keep their attention, of course, as well. So they need that. They need their focus. But more so, they're just going in straight lines back and forward. And where football, the difference with football and cycling is that catastrophic injuries happen because footballers don't just run forward and back. Well, some players might do. I mean, Dennis Irwin didn't really cut into the left or right. He just ran a straight line and did well with it. But the twisting and turning in football is completely different. And unfortunately, a lot of these experts in not just caffeine use, but then sort of they come from other sports, they don't understand that football is a completely different beast.
You kind of touched on it there with Leicester. So it's your belief that there's some sort of caffeine overdosing going on at Liverpool, which you mentioned them cycling off. So you don't think that they're going to continue that usage this season. You also mentioned 22 of 34 of their, so 35 of their players, 63% of the squad are asthmatic. What is the reason behind that? And is that unusual? Two, what do you think the reasons for that might be? And obviously, I have to throw in a couple of allegedlys in here, because this is obviously very, very dodgy ground to be discussing. And you know, I think you said you got this data from Liverpool themselves, but I mean, is it speculation to perhaps wonder what the reasons behind that is? Is there examples or parallels we can draw with cycling? Because for one of the hardest endurance races, well, if not the hardest endurance race known to man, the Tour de France, there's a lot of people who are asthmatic that compete in it.
Yeah, you know, Stephen, it's an interesting one because, you know, the information was given from the club. So, there's no dispute on that. Are a lot of footballers asthmatic? Well, actually, more than we kind of reckon. There's guys who have been asthmatic since childhood and they've been registered asthmatics for years. There's guys who've been caught puffing on an inhaler who suddenly become asthmatic, who were never asthmatic before, David Beckham being one. Which, you know, always begs the question that these guys, they're also performance athletes and they're endurance athletes. So they need to both be able to run for a long time and also be able to perform for a long time and perform at a high level constantly. At the end of 90 minutes doesn't make a difference. You keep going. In cycling, of course, we know with Chris Froome, where the amount of puffs that he took, he had to get 60 puffs on his inhaler before he went to do an interview and to take a dope test.
60?
Yeah. I mean, most people, it would kill a dog, but they said actually it wouldn't kill a dog because he got off from a charge simply because he said they did an experiment on a dog and said that that's normal and he has a different metabolism that breaks down the inhaler, the chemicals differently. So, you know, when we see, for example, look at like British Cycling, we've got Dr. Freeman who'd been working with the Team Sky with British Cycling. And he's what now? He's lost 4 laptops, or he destroyed one with a screwdriver because he was afraid that teenage Indian hackers would break in and take his information. And they don't know who ordered testosterone, who ordered Viagra. Like, I mean, there's all these different things in cycling, for example, as you mentioned, it doesn't make sense. So the inhaler will open up the lungs and give that little bit extra endurance to keep going that little bit further. Now, I was on a show on BBC4 and we were discussing doping in Russia. There has always been doping in Russia. There's no dispute about it. I've fought for years to try and say, look, this is here. I speak openly about it. No one has ever touched me. No one's ever said anything wrong because I've proved here, look, here's this happening here where they're going to. And we were speaking about that on the background that Russia is bad and Russia should be banned forever. This is 4 years ago. And I said, yeah, Russia needs a kick in the backside. But look at sport in general. I mean, those athletes are finishing 6th, 7th, and 8th. Look who's finished 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And we saw, for example, in the last Winter Olympics in South Korea, the Norwegian ski team, cross-country and biathlon team, was it 50,000 doses of asthma medicine. You know, they were all asthmatic. So why is this important to say related back to Liverpool? They need that bit of a boost. They need an excuse to be able to use an inhaler to get them that little bit, that extra few yards to keep going. There are undoubtedly players who are asthmatic. We can't dispute that. There are players who are asthmatic, so they need it there anyway.
People that have been asthmatic as kids, they'll be asthmatic as 50-year-old men.
Yeah. I mean, there are lads who are asthmatic and they need it there and we should be supporting that. That's like to inclusivity. And, you know, after the article came out, for example, all I heard from Liverpool fans, the greatest reaction was, sure, they're all at it. Look at Man City. They're all at it. Look at Arsenal. Yeah, that's the Lawrence Armstrong excuse of, I doped because I had to stay at the top because everyone else was doping. And when he was, of course, stripped of his titles, they couldn't give it to the second place or the third place or the fourth place. They had to drop all the way down. And there was no one there who had never failed. So,
but Lance Armstrong never failed, did he?
Pardon?
Lance Armstrong never failed a test. 200-300 tests never failed.
This is the whole thing. And even when he did fail a test, he got a backdated excuse to say, well, I had a saddle sore. My masseur rubbed this cream on me that actually, you know, had contained X, Y, and Z. So of course I failed, but I failed. But look, I already have an excuse. We've seen it, for example, when Fancy Bears exposed a lot of Russian and like non-Russian athletes, and there were backdated therapeutic use exemptions. Why is that important? Because it means you can soup up as much as you want, take whatever you want, say, I'm asthmatic, I need whatever it is, but you're asthmatic after the fact, after you've been caught. And now nothing is left to chance in professional sport, especially with big teams, especially in a big business like Liverpool. And also when we look as well, it's noticeable how many of the Boston Red Sox are also asthmatic, which of course is the home team of the owners of Liverpool in Boston. A lot of asthmatics, a lot of drug failures, and a lot of PED abuse, the performance-enhancing drug abuse in Boston. So does it just stop at the Atlantic and doesn't cross? Well, we'd like to think yes, but most likely no. And when we have it coming from Germany as well, it's kind of like the UK and Ireland are completely caught in the middle.
For everyone that's sitting there watching this going, but you know, the Premier League tests for drugs and stuff like that, viewers will know, obviously, I'm a huge MMA fan. But prior to USADA drug testing standards in the UFC, the UFC used to do urine tests, which is essentially all that the Premier League does right now. The MMA fighters that were juiced to their tits, self-admittedly juiced to their tits, used to say that passing that urine test is an intelligence test. I was not tested once in 5 years playing Super League. And I was talking to the lads the other day about it. When I got my contract was 3 pages. And there's about 70 pages of the things that you're not allowed to take. And there's actually loads of things on there that you wouldn't imagine. Sudafed, Benadryl, Vicks nasal spray. These sorts of things contain like nandrolone and stuff like that. And you're not allowed to take them. I took it serious. I thought this is a serious thing. It was only like in hindsight when I look back, like, I never got drug tested. Not once. I got tested more in the armed forces. I used to get tested once a year, every single year, when I was in the armed forces. Again, that was a piss test. The era of the UFC, which predates USADA, is known as the steroid era, where drug tests were happening and people were failing them. And I'm sure people are still doing stuff now, but they called that the steroid era. And you can look at some of the physiques of some of the fighters, and even actually the flow of some of the fights is different in that time versus the way it is now, because I think it's probably 60 or 70% cleaner, but I don't think it's 100% clean. The Premier League 17-18 conducted 1,923 tests, and they all came back clean. Even from just a pure statistics point of view, that doesn't seem likely, does it?
No. But Stephen, like, I mean, you're dead right pointing out MMA. You know, also look at boxing. And we look at the amount of players, for example, or boxers. The likes of Tommy Morrison, who was juiced to the gills. And, you know, it was obvious that he was doing it. And only later on they said, oh, yeah, he was juiced up. You could see the fighting technique, the fighting style, and so on and so forth. Mike Tyson recently came out and said he used to put his baby's urine into a fake penis to pass drug tests. And they're just pee tests. So they're not testing in DNA, which is what happened with, for example, some of the Russian athletes who failed, was that the woman was tested and she had, it was male DNA in her test. So it's like, okay, how did that happen? One excuse was, oh, well, I had sex before I, you know, went out, and it was from blah, blah, blah. I was like, well, okay, that could be the case. Then it turned out that the urine that was there wasn't even hers, the female urine. So I was like, okay, what's happening here? It's so famous. It's so famous. And I mean, with those number of tests that you named from 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, in the English Premier League, I mean, there was a point where for 18 months in the Scottish Premier League or Scottish football, there wasn't a single test done. So the urine tests, as a boxer, I did urine tests. I did about four let's say from senior career, from 19 to 29. So in 10 years, I did four tests, all urine. And three of them were in Germany, one in Ireland. And I knew I didn't take anything, but I knew guys who were taking stuff, but they almost purposely avoided testing them. There's guys taking diuretics, which were banned. There's guys taking, one of the guys who would always take a methamphetamine before he went into the ring, or a version of it. He wasn't tested. And the same in Germany, you know. So these guys were like coming in absolutely wild in the ring, and, you know, or cutting weight, coming into the ring and nothing happening. There was me thinking, okay, I'll be, you know, like goody goody two shoes, and I'll be okay, and I'll just do everything clean and just, like, you know, have a fried breakfast in the morning. That's what I'm going to win on. It doesn't work. And the same with English football. I mean, football in general is terrible. If we broaden it out from, say, caffeine to, which again is, this is related back to Liverpool as well, not just, of course, but to our point of our discussion, that the abuse of painkillers is also terrible. And if a lot of tests do not detect the painkillers. Now, we know about it. We hear about rugby players. We see Maradona, and we hear of players that they're taking so many painkiller injections directly into the knee, for example, that every so often they have to stop and have the knee scraped out to take it off because it's deteriorating the bone and the bone breaks down. You know, Roy Keane openly admits getting injections into his hip. Then he has to get a hip replacement before he's 40. So there's, you know, there's that abuse as well. And some year, last year we finished a survey, the start of this year, and went into the use of painkillers. And again, a lot of them are not given the exemptions for it, or they are given exemptions, but these are super, super high-powered painkillers to keep guys going. So again, this relates back to when you're going at a high pace, nonstop, your body is gradually breaking down. And especially in the English Premier League, the amount of wear and tear on bones. Put into that then, you have painkillers, and that all reacts, starts to break down the body. And eventually then you've got catastrophic muscle, joint injuries. And then further down the line, you've got a lot of psychological issues. So, I mean, there is that as well. And that's why a lot of clubs will go hard at it for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then suddenly they know. And this all relates back to cycling, where they will put guys, push them hard as possible, especially the domestiques in cycling, you know, the water carriers. They push them very, very hard, and then they take them off. And again, like the top guys, they can coast through, but the bottom guys need a little bit of time off. So kind of the 3 year spell of going hard at it has passed for Liverpool, and now, even though they're still trying to push very, very hard, you'll see the injuries and issues starting to build up, and not just COVID as well.
Wow. On the painkiller thing, that one hits home a little bit, because I probably took way more painkillers playing rugby league than I should have done, and that wasn't under any club doctor usage. There was never any club officials that ever said, take this. It was usually, I was an academy player, so it was usually senior players that would be like, I think you need to get on this, mate. I there was at one point I sort of realised how much I was taking when I didn't have some, and I had to ask my mum to get me some. I was taking Copaque, which is a cancer painkilling medication, and I was they were like flying saucers. Remember them? They were like that kind of size. You almost had to eat them with a knife and fork. I was taking two of them because I'd run out of ibuprofen, and then I liked the sort of feeling that I got on those. I would take probably 18 Pro Plus, which would be two sheets. They come in sheets of 9, which is probably caffeine overdosing, I imagine. I don't know what level of caffeine overdosing that, or where the regulations on, but I'm pretty sure it's overdosing. I'd have 2 bananas and 2 cans of Red Bull, and I'd be ready to go. And I would put in, you know, for anyone who watches rugby league, the numbers in rugby union are a little bit different, but I'd be putting in 40, 50 tackles, no problem. And that was my game, and that's probably why I got as far as I did, was work rate, and it was probably largely in down to not feeling a fucking thing. But it'd be like I'd been in a car crash the next day. I'd be in tatters. Like I had a conversation with a friend of mine who also played professional, and I was like, did your veins ever hurt in your forearms? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, because I haven't played for so long, and I remember that ache of your veins just aching the next day because of the impact that you would get. Because rugby league, a lot of the tackles in rugby league are arm sort of tackles. you take a lot of elbows, knees, hips, shoulders. On the inside of your forearms, you often see people strap the forearm up or wear a swinging arm pad. It never occurred to me that that would be overdosing. Chael Sonnen's a fascinating listen, and Chael Sonnen's podcast is a fascinating, honest podcast. He got done for taking testosterone. He got away with it for a long time with a TUE. And the other thing about the testosterone TUEs is that a lot of the fighters that are getting the exemption, or used to be getting the exemption because you're not allowed to get it anymore, they were getting the exemption for low testosterone probably because they blasted themselves on steroids beforehand, and now it's giving them a low testosterone reading, meaning that they get to take testosterone again. He got caught taking steroids and is 100% honest about his use, why he used it, how he used it, how it improved his performance, how it allowed him to train and recover, which was the main use for doing it. But he also taught me something which I wasn't aware of, talking purely on caffeine, because caffeine is obviously a controlled substance. MMA fighters get piss tested post-fight. So there is a limit in the terms of the amount of caffeine that they can take. And he used to say he used to get a venti and an espresso from Starbucks. Most of the fights that he would take were in America. He would have that walking into the stadium, drink that, drink the espresso, and that was his legal limit. Like, if he had one more cup of regular coffee, that would have put him over. And he said like that was a very important amount of caffeine for him to take. I think people underestimate how powerful a drug caffeine is, or how powerful a supplement caffeine can be. There's another article that you did as well, which was a football free-for-all goes viral, which talks about the England doctor who's also involved in the Mo Farah scandal and stuff like that. How widespread do you think, I don't want to say PED usage, but I kind of do want to say PED usage. So let's fuck it, let's say it. How widespread do you think PED usage is? Because I've got friends that are strength and conditioning coaches in the Premier League, and I've asked them, and I've gone, come on, man, I know you know the score. And they've said that they don't think it's that prevalent, and I'm going to be real, I don't believe them.
Well, if we combine, I mean, your story about the painkillers, you know, it upsets me when I hear it. For the simple reason is that when we're in there, I know myself, you know, when I went into the ring with both hands broken, because I was expected to go in because it was a thing to do. I had to, for what, and you know, so I'm 25, 26 years of age thinking, oh yeah, I'll live forever. Now, I am fortunate that, like, you know, I'm not end up with like mad arthritis in my hands and so on. But I know guys who have, and who had less injuries than me, who had less punches than me, because again, same in rugby league, the amount of, you know, from concussion to the body punishment, it wears you down. So, I mean, painkillers, you say, they make you feel invincible sometimes, you know, and that's a very, very dangerous thing. And it's something that we see in cycling, for example, where guys are so hopped up on different, you know, there's certain drugs that they'll take, painkillers, very, very strong, and they lose concentration. We see these horrible crashes, and at points where there shouldn't be a crash, simply because the guys, you know, the motor skills go down, the control focus goes down, and that's where they start to get injuries and fall. In terms of how widespread, if we say then, if we include PED into PEDs, painkillers, not just caffeine, not just testosterone, not just, you know, the super drugs that we know are there, like EPO, for example, the one that cancer patients use, which puts more, you know, oxygen into the bloodstream, supposedly to help you get over chemotherapy, to help you improve.
Is that what it was created for?
Pardon?
Is that what EPO was created for?
Yeah.
Because I know it's the drug of choice for everyone who's doing Tour de France, isn't it?
Exactly. And also EPO means you maintain, you lose weight, you get the same, like the muscles stay effective, and you have greater endurance. So even before Lance Armstrong, yeah, there was like some fat cyclists, some skinny cyclists, some hefty, like big muscular cyclists. Now they're all kind of the same. They're all lean, hard, hungry. If we look at the English Premier League, look at Liverpool, there's no Jan Mobys in there. You know, there's not even, someone like a big hefty lad. They're all lean, mean specimens. There's not a pick on them. And they still have the same stamina. and they still have the same muscle strength. So, you know, it is, if we, okay, we include EPO into then the PED. So, it is a PED. Is it prevalent in the English Premier League? Is it prevalent in football and world sports? Well, let's just say English Premier League. Yes, it has to be. There's no two ways about it. Not just from anecdotal, from people I've spoken with, from ex-players who are not long retired, from off-the-record chats with players, contact with people from clubs, they would say that either it's within the club or the players go to somebody outside the club and they get recommendations. And that's a dangerous one. When it is controlled, like, for example, in North American sports, Major League Baseball, NFL, they have it controlled inside. And we know how awful their testing is there. I mean, it's basically a joke. And, you know, you get done for a PED, you miss 1 week's game. You know, that one week. I mean, it's mad when that happens, but it's a warning. But they also, it's all done in-house. The guys who fail are the guys who go outside for help. They go to, for example, Balco. They go to, you know, to all these, like, doping experts. And that's the danger, that, you know, there is PED use. There's no two ways about it. How widespread is it? I think it's there in all clubs. I think that at the very, very top, they do it better. And when you have people, let's just say, it's like, it's not about smelling smoke. It's about seeing the fire. For example, you know, Pep Guardiola, who had been done in his time, working with doping doctors, working in doping clubs, and he gets done for doping himself. And now he's there with, after falling out in Bayern Munich, because he wanted to bring in his specialists, his fitness and medicine specialists, at the expense of a German doctor who is, you know, well, Dr. Healing Hands, who has worked with players from Michael Owen. He's worked with super athletes, like Usain Bolt. And he does it like with herbal recipes, herbal remedies, with, you know, the placenta of a baby, of a female goat. I mean, all these mad stuff that's, oh yeah, this is, it's herbal, it's okay. Marijuana is also herbal, but that's also a PED. So,
why do you think the authorities in England cover this up? And I have no qualms saying that, because we all know that failed drug tests are covered up by the English FA, and I'm happy to strongly state that, because we know that that's the case. Why do you think that is the case?
It's kind of, I read it very, very quickly back. I'll say, I would like to say money. I'd like to say prestige and power and control. But I'd also, I think the key element is fear. Because in Russia, for example, Russia did bad at the Vancouver Winter Olympics, really, really badly. They were going to lead up net to a home Olympics in Sochi, where they're like, Jesus, we need to do well, boys. If we don't, we're in a huge amount of pain and trouble, because we spent all this money. Like, there's so much money stolen from the construction of the sites, from the hotels. It's like, you know, if we don't win and distract everybody, we're in big trouble. So, long story short with that was, Putin wasn't happy. The sports minister knew he wasn't happy, said to his officials, the boss isn't happy. Make sure we have the best athletes and they're going to win medals. What does that translate as? It translates as, do whatever it takes to win. And they did. So from arrest, from about to jail a guy who was up on murder charges, which is Grigory Rodchenkov, who was up on murder charges from selling doping products to athletes who then died. They were like, listen, this guy knows his stuff. He has contacts everywhere. He works with WADA. He worked with UK anti-doping. He's an expert. They bring him back into the fold. This is a guy who advised the British, the London Olympics 2012, who advised UK anti-doping, who advised all the top authorities how to work the system, and basically knew what was going on in the world. It's a whole network. So the English FA, they're not going to turn around and say, they're not going to try and, you know, uncover anything, because if they do, they don't know what they're going to find. And I think that's the most, it's fear that's killing them. Of course, it's fear of losing money, but it's fear of what is there lying underneath the surface, like it happened in Russia when you had a lot of Russian journalists going, no, that's a Western conspiracy. We've never doped. And then the next thing is, well, they're all doping, so we had to dope. They still haven't come to the part yet to go, we've got a problem. We need to actually address it and dig into it, as we're doing now. And, you know, I think that the reason the FA don't want, they don't want to find people are doping, because it means there's been a failure in the entire system the whole way up. And ultimately, it's a loss of face. And it just boils back to fear, Stephen, that they fear so many things, losing money, losing power. And also, let's call a spade, or a bent organization or organizations, bent organizations. UEFA do not want to find out that the English FA have been turning a blind eye. And FIFA definitely do not want to turn around and say, oh my God, this has been happening all the time under our watch. So if it was just English FA, we could kick them around the place and say, these are a load of scumbags. You know, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You're allowing this to happen. And in order for a young 16-year-old to aspire to play for England or play at the top level, they need to put this crap into their system and shorten their lives, or, you know, live with this their whole lives and get the mental and physical, like, results of it. No one wants to know that. So it's basically, it's fear the whole way up the line. And unfortunately, it's not going to change. And the likes of shadow bans that we see in tennis, that we see in ice hockey, for example, when players suddenly get injured for half a season, they've got a bad knee injury, and that they're videoed out dancing in a nightclub with not a bother on them. You know, questions remain to be asked, but it won't change, Stephen, I'm sad to say.
Well, there's been a couple of high profile cases. Obviously, the phenomenal, possibly one of the best documentaries ever made, Icarus. In that documentary, they mentioned very briefly, because it wasn't the focus of the Winter Olympics, and cycling were the two that he was sort of aiming at, but they mentioned football teams, so potentially the Russian football team, and then obviously we all saw the incredible cardiovascular performances from Russia at the home World Cup. There was also talk of the Dr. Fuentes case, where he had bags of blood and his evidence was all written down, and the Spanish courts ordered it all to be burnt. I believe that got saved, but no one's actually done anything with that. But supposedly there's a confession from Fuentes from prison, and I don't know how reliable that is, but he said if all this comes to light, Spain are giving back the World Cup. You know, there's massively high profile cases of this where you think, why hasn't anybody dug into this? And it makes no sense to me. If you're a footballing organisation and they make the noises about wanting to be seen as being clean, their actions tell me that they don't want to be seen as being clean. And I think that's the sad thing in this is. And ultimately, that, you know, these conversations that we're having aren't happening on a wide enough, broad enough scale, because I think people are too frightened to.
Stephen, this boils back down to fear again. They're afraid to do it. I'm under no illusion. Now, I commentated on the World Cup from that opening game with Russia, Saudi Arabia, when they basically were chasing the ball a lot of the game, and the Saudis were, well, we know they were fasting for Ramadan, and that was they just weren't good enough. To be honest, they weren't good enough, and people were asking questions of the Russian team, and I agreed with that. Have to ask questions. If you don't ask questions, hindsight and history is going to judge you very, very badly. Two Russian journalists at as a favor to me, up in St. Petersburg at a presser, asked Gareth Southgate, are you not worried about Dr. Rob Chakravarty working with you when he's under investigation for not recording what he's giving to Mo Farah, and for working with Bolton Wanderers and all the clouds of suspicion over him? The other English, or not the other, the English journalists who were there told him to shut up. This isn't the place or time. It's like, well, there has to be the place.
It's very much both, actually.
Yeah.
It's clearly the place, it's clearly the time.
Exactly. This guy is sitting here, and England, I tipped England to win the World Cup, by the way. I or at least get to the final. Not that they had a generational group of players that were just very, very good. But anyway,
nothing to do with a suspicious doctor.
I was very sad when they lost to Croatia. I was there in the stadium. I was speaking with Martin Keown and Stan Collymore, and we were like speaking up in the press box, and it was like, you know, it's an honour to be here. It's a pleasure to be here. And I said, I take no pleasure to see England lose, none whatsoever. I wanted to see them win. I was torn because I knew quite a few of the Croatian players. I'd lived and worked in Croatia, and I wanted to see them do well. But at the same time, it was great seeing England go so far, and hopefully to push that a bit further. But in terms of with the different cases, I mean, media don't want to ask. And you've got a lot of journalists who are pampered, and they're sitting there, for example, and they will criticize a player or a coach, or they'll slag off the organization, and they'll sit there in the press box. A privilege, like, you know, this time, any other time doesn't make a difference, but especially now when people can't go to stadiums in England, for example, they're not asking questions. Why, for example, why are so many Liverpool players now getting injuries? Why is this? We've heard about this with asthmatics. Can you tell us how many of your players are asthmatic? It's not rocket science. Players should be prepared to come and say, I'm an asthmatic. I've suffered from it all my life. I'm overcoming it, and I'm a role model. Journalists won't say that. First of all, they're afraid to lose access. Second of all, it's not interesting for them. That's not going to sell newspapers, because that's not what they're good at. They're a bit afraid of it as well. And most of them have no life experience. How many journalists, Stephen, would you know who played professional sport at any level?
Probably none, because most of them probably went straight to university to start doing whatever they needed to do to get on the path of being a journalist.
Exactly. I mean, I've played in a journal, like a football match. Now, I played semi-professional soccer and football, sorry, and I boxed internationally, and I've played rugby to a decent amateur level, and sport is my life. I mean, Gaelic Games, GAA from Ireland, that's still play, still coach. As sport is everything for me, but at the same time, I'm not so naive to say that like all is hunky dory. But most of the journalists, they have no idea what goes in. For example, the pain you have to go through to get your body out of bed after you've been playing, I don't know, like, you know, you've been playing up in against Lee or against Hull, Kingston Rovers, and you've been smashed on the pitch for two halves of a game. And the next day you can't straighten your leg because somebody took you out the knees. So they don't understand that. So if they don't understand it, how then can they ask? How come the players ran so far, so hard, and so fast, and put in the tackles and did all these things, like to just even kicking the ball is going to wear your muscles out? How can the players do that nonstop, as well as training? Remember, it's training as well as key in this, as well as all the training, and then go out the next day or three days later and perform just as well. They don't understand it. So how can they ask the questions? The most that they would be is to say, listen, lads, don't drink caffeine. Or for some of them, don't do coke for a couple of weeks and see what happens. No caffeine, no stimulants, and see what happens for a couple of weeks. What happens to your body and your brain? It's not pretty. So I think that in that case, in case like, you know, journalists don't want to ask questions, and the ones who do, they're called weirdos. I mean, I've been accused to hate Liverpool, even though last October, I said it from certain, like I said, that's it. When you beat City, they've won a title. That's it. Payout. And great to see Liverpool win. I'm happy to see them win. I have as many Liverpool, being from Ireland, as many Liverpool friends as Manchester United friends. So I'm happy. My brother's a Liverpool fan. One of my best friends is a Liverpool fan. I'm happy for them that they win, because they've, since childhood, they've gone to games, they've followed them, they've lived and died. It's good to see them win. But at the same time, don't be an idiot. Don't be naive. Don't say, no. That's it's magical. It's magic. You know, it's, as I say, like, you know, in Russia, I spoke with one ex gymnast, and this will give you a laugh, and your viewers will like this as well. I spoke with a gymnast who is now in her 50s, early 50s, and she said that she was put on a trial, and this is, God honest truth, this is deathly serious. She was put on a trial back when she was 18, 19, so 30-odd years ago, coming towards the Olympics. She was on the USSR team, and coming up towards the Olympics, they needed to control their weight. There were issues because they said, like, you know, that some of them were underperforming, even though they're girls in their late teens, but they need to control their weight. So they infected each, there was a whole group, there was like 20 gymnasts. They infected 10 of them with parasites, worms. They gave them worms. This worked. It kept their weight down. But it also took away nutrients and minerals and basically meant that they weren't getting the value of the food that they were eating going into their system. Then they were cycling off. And the word cycling is very important for this because they're cycling off after 3 months of this in their winter training. Because they weren't competing, they were just training. So they were losing the weight and getting stronger, getting better, but getting unhealthier. To cycle off then, they get on this, the name is escaping me right now, this massively toxic drug to get rid of this stuff that actually is it gets based in your liver, these parasites go into your liver, to give it to them, which it can only be, can only be administered in the safety of a hospital. It's a pill, but it could actually stop your heart. It could stop your liver functioning, and then you know, it's just absolute, just complete meltdown in the whole body. And they did that. But suddenly, of the 10 girls, 9 of them were so violently ill that they basically quit gymnastics. And the one girl who came through it went on and took part of the Olympic team, but, you know, it just completely wrecked her immune system afterwards. That's the lengths that they were willing to go to. And the athletes were assured by the doctors, this is enough for you. Like, you'll be okay, you'll be safe. And the athletes made the choice. Doesn't matter their age, they were 18, 19, they were young women. At that age, girls are a lot more clued in than we will be as men. They took it because it was the best chance to get up to the Olympic team to win a medal. So this is what we're dealing with. And the media are never going to cover it. Because why? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, I hate saying that, but at the end of the day, the people watching at home don't care. I don't think Liverpool, Liverpool reaction, the fans' reaction was, well, they're all at it. Man City, look at them. They have Pep Guardiola. Okay. Dig back into Jurgen Klopp's history and minds and see what he's done there. See what's happened in Dortmund. Have a look at the assistant manager. Fans don't care. So when we look at, like, the, you know, what goes on, like, they're not going to lose. Fans are going to turn away. This year, for example, was the first year, I'd say, in over a decade that I watched the Tour de France almost in full every day. And I enjoyed it. Now I had to turn off my brain and just watch the beautiful sights and how beautiful France was and the majesty of the countryside. And then at certain points when you see, for example, the Slovenians, and Slovenia has been always a very good cycling nation, just blowing away other teams, blowing away other cyclists and thinking, well, it's the same old, but really, do I care? No, because after that, I won't watch cycling again till next year. And the same with Wimbledon, the same with, you know, we all want to be tennis stars when Wimbledon comes around. And with football, you know, will people care if their fan, if their team wins the Premier League? Do you care that your players are all doped up? I don't know. It's, you know, do I have concerns with Dundalk, for example, seeing their, you know, the fitness, the ability, the stamina, the strength compared to other Irish teams? Yeah, I asked questions. I didn't feel very, very comfortable. But, you know, am I happy to see them win the league? Of course. Am I happy to see them getting into Europe? Of course. But again, I ask questions and I ask it openly as a fan. I'm not accusing them of anything. I haven't dug into it. Maybe that means I'm a bad journalist. I should be digging into my own club and seeing what's going on behind the scenes.
And, you know, for everybody going, oh, I mean, we briefly spoke beforehand. There's never actually been many, certainly in the most recent dominant Manchester United era, there was never any really red flags. There was never anything really on top. But Harry Gregg and it might have been Albert Scanlon admitted to taking amphetamines in the 50s. So this is stuff that's been around for the longest time. And like you said, if you said, you know what, United are going to go and have absolutely bright green piss for the next 2 years, but we're going to win a treble again, I'd be like, fucking bring it on, bottle that shit, let's go. Like, I don't know if I'd care. I don't know if I would, because, you know, the most enjoyable times watching MMA was looking at the likes of Alistair Overeem and going, fucking hell, I bet he could piss a urinal in half. Look at him. And you know that everyone's off their tits on everything. The Uberim era was amazing. And like you said, maybe, you know, I'm going to say I don't know. Alan's the guy with the information here. I just wanted to come and speak to him. Maybe there is something in what happened with Liverpool. Maybe there is something that happened with Manchester City. Maybe that Barcelona team was on all sorts of stuff. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. Football doesn't give a fuck enough to drill into it, to start correcting it. So if you can't beat them, maybe it is fucking time to join them.
Listen, Stephen, you're dead right. Why, like, why should we be bothered in many ways? why should I care? Like, I mean, why should you care? Why should it be important to say that's dangerous? Do you know what you're taking? Because I've had it. I had it with players. One of the reasons why I quit working in full time sports back in 2013, and I literally walked away from very lucrative job with a management agency. I just said I couldn't take it anymore because there was two things happened. Well, two main things happened. One was I said to a tennis player, said to a footballer that if he continued taking painkillers as he was doing and getting injections to play, because I asked him to retire, he said, no, I want to get one more contract. And that's what he went and did it. But it ended up that a couple of years ago, about 5 years ago now, he was living basically homeless because his hip gave out and he found out that the club hadn't been paying his insurance. So to get the hip operation, I had to rally around and get a few footballers to, like ex-clients, to give money to help pay for this guy to get a replacement hip because he was basically homeless. He gave his wife, handed the keys to the car, the house, and left because the pain he was suffering was so much that he was impossible to be home. He said it struck home to one day where the second youngest sat on his knee. He couldn't sleep in the bed. He could only sleep sitting up because if he slept in the bed, he couldn't get out of bed in the morning. And of course, there was no aftercare after he quit and so on. So the little one sat on his knee. And he pushed her off his knee. The amount of pain that he had, he pushed her off his knee. She fell on the ground. The wife said to him, why are you doing this? Because he basically couldn't sleep, couldn't eat. He was all over the place. And this is a fellow who didn't, you know, touch drugs, drink or smoke. So he was clean, you know, one of these like box-to-box midfielders, always hard tackling. Should have gone to England when he had a chance, but didn't. But he was basically living in a room with 16 or 15 other men. Basically, it was called a workers' hostel. Like we would call it a doss house, I guess, at home, where most of them were either homeless or working like little small jobs. That's how he was trying to survive. So I saw that and was like, before that happened, I was like, no, that's not good. And I saw everyone from the clubs all turn their faces away going, what use is he? Just a piece of meat, he's finished. And the second was with tennis. A young tennis player, 16 years of age, terrific junior player. She was just after breaking into the top 15 of juniors in the world. She was already as a professional ranked top 500. This is a girl that we had gotten up to Ireland once for a training week with our former Irish tennis coach. We were doing things right that we were saying, look, you're going to hit your peak at 22, 23, 24. Don't push yourself yet. We've got time. You know, everything's okay. The parents then were promised by one agent that they would get her to a coach who would immediately make her number one in the world as a junior. And, you know, at 20, she would be making millions, you know. Love looking lassie, very clever, very you know, but a child in every way, shape, or form. And they said, we're going to send her off to this tennis coach in Switzerland. And I said, no, no. And I said, look, you can't do that. And it turned out that they'd already sent her. And this guy was a registered sex offender who preyed on young female tennis players. And I said to the parents, to the mother, I said, are you insane? You put your daughter over there with a pedophile. And I said, I know what he's going to say. I said, you're going to put him over there. And the things he'll say is, you're too fat, you're bad footwork, you've got bad balance, and you're too lippy, you're too mouthy. So you need to lose weight, train such and such a way to get better balance, and then to you know, obey the rules and do what you're told. And the mother went quiet. And I said, you've already sent her there. She goes, yeah. And I said, listen, you know the guys, you know, you've spoken with Conchita Martinez. She told you directly what this guy is. And the mother says, yes, but he gets results. And ultimately, that's a parent putting their child in harm's way to get results. They weren't a poor family. It wasn't like, oh, they needed the money. They didn't need the money. They were well-to-do. They were intelligent, well-educated, well-traveled, but they didn't care. They wanted to get results. At that point, I said I had to walk away. And now more and more, Steve, if you look at it, would I care if Dundalk went on to win the UEFA Champions League or the UEFA Europa League? They won't win it this year, but they won the Europa League this year and created history for Irish clubs. Would I be really, really sad? No. Would I celebrate? I'd be happy, because I'd be happy for the people of the town. Thinking of my dad, who was a big Dundalk fan, he'd be delighted. Would I take as much pleasure in it? Yeah, I probably would. And would it feel dirty? Like you said, who cares? Like, you know, who cares? Again, go back to the thing again. When the article came out, the original article came out, the reaction from Liverpool fans was, so what? So what? We won the league. You're all jealous. Actually, you're all doing it anyway. And ultimately, that won't change. But if we can educate young players and say, don't do that. Try not to do it. Don't end up broken. Don't end up in bits. Don't end up injured. Make the choice. So when Jurgen says you need to take this drink or you need to take this injection, say, nah, no chance. No way. I'm not going to take it. What happens? He kicks you out. If everyone does that, okay, there'll always be some idiots who'll say, yeah, I'll take it. I'll do whatever it is to win. But if more and more don't, then we can start to believe sport. But do I think it's ever going to happen? No, never, 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 never. No hope.
Alan, I can't get over the tennis story for starters. That's fucking wild. But thank you for joining us. I will throw a link to Alan's Twitter below. Go and give him a follow. I'll also throw a link to the article, Why Liverpool Won't Win the League This Year. Bear in mind, it's 10-week-ish old. It's eerily, eerily accurate in terms of the prediction. And there's some fantastic information in there as well. Alan, thank you for joining me. This was fantastic. And for you guys, make sure to subscribe. Get any questions and comments and anything like that. And if you'd like us to do more stuff looking into this, then I'll happily do that. But again, thank you, Alan, very much. I'll see you in the next one.